From 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today, hunger in America. The numbers will astound you. How a pyramid turned into a plate. A look at the USDA's new nutrition icon. I've got some coffee alternatives to share. A look at our complicated relationship with the tomato. Plus, I'll introduce you to the new ingredient that has chefs astir. But first, let's head out to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's fresh and in season this week in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. One of the perennial favorites at the market, of course, is the iconic California strawberry. California grows strawberries that feed practically the entire country. We have a really great inside scoop on a delicious, very scarce variety of strawberry that's here at the market now in season. And David Karp is here today. He is the well-known and well-respected Los Angeles Times writer. He's a fruit researcher. He has his own orchard of rare varieties of fruit. And he's a regular here at the market, and he helps us when he's here to point out the delicious new things we should try. So, David, right now you are very excited about this particular, it looks like pretty much your average strawberry. Tell us why it's so special.
Well, I was actually passing by the center of the market by a stand that grew strawberries when I saw Sherry Yard last week. Sherry Yard, who's the pastry chef of the Wolfgang Puck Empire, for Spago particularly. And she was holding a tray of those. I could see that they looked actually a little different. They were smaller, and many of them were rounder. A few of them had a distinctive turtleneck shape. And then the wind shifted, and just for a second, I wafted this incredibly intense aroma of wild strawberry. This is actually a garden strawberry from the name Mara des Bois, M-A-R-A-D-E-S-B-O-I-S, three words. You would think that it was a Fraise des Bois, but it isn't. What this is a French variety bred by the Marionnais French nursery, which was patented in 1991, about 20 years ago. It's not been available here commercially in the United States until just now. The Chino farm, famous Chino Nojo, down in Rancho Santa Fe in North San Diego County, very exclusive, has had them for a decade or more. But what's special about these? Number one, the intense wild strawberry aroma. Number two, there's just a lot more strawberry flavor than you get from a normal strawberry. They're small. They don't have quite the shelf life. Driscoll tried growing them, but they need 10 days to get it to New York. The people that need to grow this are farmers market growers and backyard growers. They're available from White Flower, from Norse Farms in the Northeast, from Burpee. And 100,000 plants were sold this year. I just spoke to the rights owner, up from 25,000 last year and nothing the year before.
Can you plant these any time of the year?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Certainly here in the temperate regions of coastal Southern California.
Okay, and they are available from which farmer?
Well, to the extent that they're available at all, they're available from the Pudwills. I was actually just up there in Napomo, and I saw them also, the same sort of thing. I smelled them from like 20 feet away, and they planted like 2,000 to 3,000 plants. So they will have some production, but before we get everybody so excited, they were incredible that first day. I mean, I could smell them from literally 20 feet away. Are they always going to be like that? Not necessarily. Number one, it depends very importantly on ripeness. If they're dead ripe, oh man, I can't think that there's not going to be anybody who's not going to say this is incredible. Some people actually do think that they remind them of the flavor of Pez, of fruit punch, or of bubble gum. So not everybody is going to like that, but I think almost everybody will. But if they're underripe, that can actually be tart, not particularly sweet, and deficient in aroma too.
Well, David, thank you so much as always for helping us in the right direction. I guess our noses just aren't as sensitive as yours, but thank you so much for pointing these out. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
That was David Karp, and once again, he's turned us on to a terrific, new, exciting find here at the farmer's market. And I'm looking at this little half basket of strawberries. I'm gingerly going to try to take one of those, but I know they're worth their weight in gold. Thank you so much, David.
You bet.
Right now we're talking with private chef Cece Consalvo, and Cece's a little nervous because we're surrounded by the culinary arts class from Beverly Hills High School. Chef Daryl Smith is here. He comes every year to the market. Today he's got 85 students, and they're here to shop the market and listen to what Cece has to say and learn a lot from the farmers and the chefs who are here. So Cece, we want to talk to you about what you are drawn to today and what you're going to be shopping for, and of course we hope you're going to share a recipe with us.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'd love to. One of the nice things that's popping up at the market today is the fresh tarragon.
It's incredibly fragrant. It's a sort of an underused herb, if you will. It's not real popular, but it's got so much flavor and so much of a sort of an aromatic blend to it. One of the things we like to do with it is just take the fresh leaves. You get a couple of fish fillets, maybe something like petrol sole. And what I like to do is salt, pepper, paprika, olive oil first. Rub it all over our, you know, fillets. And then I take the tarragon leaves and almost like scotch tape them to the fish, just kind of like all over. And a little chopped garlic. I also did a little bit of a sort of a Thai fusion. I got some lemongrass from Coleman. And we crack that open and just spread it over top of the fish. And literally just piling up all these really great flavors, throwing it in the broiler. Within 10 minutes, you've got this awesome, beautiful fish fillet.
Can you describe what tarragon tastes like, what that flavor is?
You know, the first part of it is sort of like this anise, licorice kind of flavor, but it also has a bit of a lemon undertone as well. Mm-hmm. And then when you heat it, it becomes very much like more fragrant than, you know, when it's raw in its raw mm-hmm. state. So heating it definitely brings out the flavor and the
so
aroma.
It's used pretty much as a cooking herb, not as something you'd strip and throw into a salad?
Oh, definitely is a fresh application, for
sure.
In fact, I even like to throw the whole bunch in into like the food processor with some olive oil, maybe a cup of olive oil, and you blend that up and then pour it through a nice like fine mesh sieve, and then you've got this wonderful tarragon oil. Then you could go down to Maggie and get a radicchio and split that and grill it. Or maybe a nice romaine head and split it, and then you get some goat cheese and drizzle some of the tarragon oil over the salad, so you've got a nice fresh salad.
That is such a great idea, and you could do that with any fresh herb, couldn't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, Cece, well, thanks so much. You're a private chef, so you do have a business and a company, and you are available for catering. Cece, thank you so much.
Laura, is my absolute pleasure. I love you. I'm your biggest fan. Thank you.
That was Cece Consalvo. She's a private chef. She's at the market regularly, and what an exciting thing to do with tarragon. I can't wait. Join us next Wednesday at the Santa Monica Wednesday Market from 10 till 1. We're going to have a guest chef, Clemence Gossette, who is the proud owner of the wonderful new Gourmandise Cooking School on the third floor in the market at Santa Monica Place. Clemence is going to be out here at the market. She's going to be making homemade vanilla ice cream with candied almonds on top. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
I've got Cece Consalvo's ideas for tarragon on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you've visited the Good Food blog lately, no doubt you've seen lots of posts about pie. That's because we're in full-blown pie mode here at KCRW. There are a few ways you can get your pie on. Every week, download the PieCast. It's a bonus podcast all about my favorite dessert. If you subscribe to the Good Food Podcast, you'll automatically get the PieCast. And we offer pie recipes from chefs and food writers every day on the Good Food blog. You can also share your own pie baking adventures with me on my Facebook page. And check out our Facebook Pie Challenge page. It's our community page all about pie. You can find links to everything pie related at kcrw.com/goodfood.
Nation, we all know the government wants to ram their health food agenda down our throats, which isn't easy to do since most of those throats are blocked by toaster strudels. Well, folks, check out the Obama administration's latest attack on our bellies.
So the U.S. government is making some new moves to get us to eat a little better. This is the old food pyramid. There it is. It's out. Out. They're going to do something completely different.
No food pyramid? Well, that was my favorite Egyptian mortuary-based nutritional diagram. Even better than the food sphinx. And what are they proposing to replace the food tomb?
The Obama administration plans to replace the much maligned food pyramid with just a plate.
A plate? For food? What's the connection? Americans don't use plates anymore. Our food comes from cases, bags, cans, tubes, and envelopes made of themselves.
That was comedian Stephen Colbert talking about the USDA's new nutrition icon, a plate, which replaced the familiar food pyramid. To talk about what exactly that means is Marion Nessel, professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University.
Hi, Evan. Good to be here.
You know, the last time you visited, we talked about the updated federal dietary recommendations. And this time, it's all about the pyramid turning into a plate.
Yes, an interesting metamorphosis.
Is it one that makes you happy?
Well, I think it's easier. Certainly the last pyramid, the one that came out in 2005, I like to refer to it as foodless and useless. It was that triangle with all the pretty color stripes coming down, and there wasn't any food on it, and you didn't know what to do with it, and you had to go on a computer if you wanted to figure all that out. This one, at least, is easier to think about, easier to teach. The recommendations that come with it are pretty simple. Make half your plate fruits and vegetables. That alone is a huge step forward.
When you imagine people looking at this plate and you see 50% of the plate is fruits and vegetables, do you think they're going to make the leap that that can be fruit juices and convenience products?
I'm not sure how people are going to interpret it. I think the first question that I've been hit with is, does that include French fries? And for that to be answered, you have to go on to the department's website. And we're back on the website again. And one of the issues there is it doesn't look to me as if the background information that they're providing on the website has changed very much. So that's where you get into the whole business about serving sizes and numbers of servings and all of the things that I thought the plate had gotten rid of. And that was one of the things I liked about it, was that you didn't need to worry about the number of servings you were eating or the size of the servings. All you had to do was have a reasonable size plate.
You know, one of the things that's intriguing to me is what's outside the plate but still part of the icon.
Yes, the milk or the dairy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been set off to the side, which is where I think it belongs. It's a food like any other. I mean, one of the questions you could ask is why fruits, vegetables, grains, half of them whole, and then the annoying protein that nutritionists like me are so huffy about. But the the business about food groups, they're arbitrary and they're decided by people who look at the whole food supply and say, well, this is a convenient way to divide them up. There are other ways of dividing them. I don't think they had to do it that way.
Do you think part of it was to head off the dairy lobby? Or does that happen before these even come out?
Well, I think that happens all the way along. And what the Department of Agriculture has to live with is that in 2005, they raised the number of servings of required dairy products from 2 to 3. It had been 2 historically for 50 years, more than that. And then all of a sudden it was 3. And here you have a plate with this thing off to the side, and the dairy industry is interpreting that as that's what you're supposed to do at every meal. And that means you have dairy products at every meal. That's not the way I would interpret it.
Now, you said that nutritionists like you get huffy about protein. Expand on that a little more.
Well, protein's not a food. It's a nutrient. Everything else on the plate is a food. It's fruits, vegetables, grains, and dairy. And then all of a sudden, you've got protein. What's that? Well, it's interesting. The people who were working on this were working with chefs a lot, and chefs know what protein is. They cook it, and that's what they call it. It's not what I would call it. I think that's the animal food sector where you have meat, poultry, fish. But, of course, beans are a source of protein, too. What annoys me about it, first of all, protein's not an issue in American diets. Most Americans have twice the amount of protein they need. They don't need to be reminded to eat protein. Secondly, grains have protein and dairy have protein. Both of those are important sources of protein in American diets. So to single out protein as its own sector just doesn't make any sense to me. But I know why they did it. They did it because they didn't want to call it the meat group when it included poultry and fish and beans. Again, one of the things I really like about it is it's food-based. It's not nutrient-based. It's about food, except for the annoying protein business. And you want kids thinking about this in terms of food, and it sort of makes the number of servings sensible. And the only thing you have to worry about is the size of the plate, which is a big worry, by the way, because plate sizes have increased so much.
Have they really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, an 8-inch plate, which is what this thing is based on, is what you now see appetizers served on. Dinner plates are much larger, and because of the ratio, pi r squared or whatever it is, for the area in a circle, a plate that's 2 inches bigger is much, much more than, I mean, it's almost twice as much. And as plate sizes in restaurants have gotten bigger and bigger, people are eating more and more food.
Do you ever see a day when the USDA drops its role as a marketing agent?
I don't see that coming soon, and certainly not in the particular political climate that we have in Washington right now, that is so pro-business and so anti-public health. I think there are people at the Department of Agriculture who are deeply interested in trying to create a healthier food system, and I see the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, as one of those people. His particular personal interest is in trying to revitalize and repopulate rural America. And I think that's a terrific goal for a Secretary of Agriculture to have. And in order to do that, he sees small farms as an absolutely vital part of that and is trying to figure out how he can use the resources of the Department of Agriculture to promote that. I think he deserves a lot of credit for that and a lot of support.
As always, it's fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much, Marion.
My pleasure.
I've been talking to Marion Nessel, professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at NYU. Her blog, Food Politics, is not to be missed. Coming up after this short break, I'll introduce you to a new ingredient that has some LA chefs very excited. Stay tuned. You're listening to Good Food here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. Confession to make. I love pork, I love crisp, crackling, lovely bacon, and the yielding meat cooked underneath all that fat, but I've never fallen in love with pork belly in its soft, tender manifestation. It's just a little too much for me. So I'm excited to hear that another meaty ingredient might enter the zone of fascination for chefs. Chris Morningstar, executive chef of Ray's at LACMA, is falling in love with beef tendons.
Beef tendon is essentially a ligament. I never dreamed of having it. The first time I heard of it, one of my sous chefs had worked at New York for 4 years at Nobu, and then she went out drinking one night, and they landed at a place and saw beef tendon, of course, had to order it. I think they said they ordered 6 orders of it after that. And our fascination at that point was peaked. And so, you know, from then on, it was trying to find it and figuring out how to cook it and then how to cook it different ways. Since it's most often used in Asian cuisine, our goal was to find ways to bring it into you know a frame of mind that for our restaurant was Mediterranean.
How I know beef tendon is Taiwanese beef tendon soup.
Sure, and I think a classic ingredient in pho.
Yeah. So describe the mouthfeel of it when it's properly cooked.
Properly cooked, beef tendon is that rich, gelatinous, forgive the analogy, that braised or smoked jiggly beef fat goodness that you just want to eat and off the prime rib and just sit there and eat it. It has that amazing lusciousness. However, it's almost completely fat-free.
Yeah, it's cartilaginous.
Right.
So it has, when it's cooked, it I love it because it's that soft, chewy, yeah, yum. Mm. Tell me what you're doing with it.
Well, we constantly are trying new things with it. The first time we did it, we did start doing it with a red braise, which would be kind of a Chinese style of doing it with soy, sugar, ginger, scallions, and bringing it to cooking it to its, you know, that falling apart great texture, and then bringing it down and having a sauce, and then pairing it with earthy flavors, mushrooms, and then sharp flavors such as apricot mostarda and some greens to kind of bring bitterness to balance through the richness of the dish. One of the dishes that we did recently was a salad of it. The interesting thing about it, the tendon, is it has different textures. And when it is cold, it is a very hard texture.
It's crunchy.
It has a little bit of mouth bite to it. So we started shaving it super thin and almost into noodles and then making a salad out of it. And especially as it gets to warmer weather, we're looking to create a lighter feeling food. And in doing that, we did a pickled vegetable salad with it, with watermelon, radishes, carrots, coriander leaves, mint, and kind of bright and fresh along with it.
Wow. So when you're talking about doing that, serving it cold in a salad, shaving it, you're cooking it first.
Yes, we're cooking it the exact same way. We're cooking it for 10 to 12 hours until it's super tender and falling apart. It just so happens that maybe more than any other protein I've seen, when it's warm state to cold state are so drastically different. Usually a beef short rib, you cook it, it's falling apart, but cold, it's firm, but it's not that firm. And this is very firm and has that kind of crunch to it.
So is this a candidate for sous vide?
It is a great candidate for sous vide. All of the proteins that I've tried so far in sous vide cooking respond very well to it.
Describe what sous vide is.
Sous vide cooking literally means under vacuum. The process of sous vide cooking is to put a piece of protein or a vegetable or anything, to put it into a bag, to cryovac it, removing all of the air from the bag, and then cook it for a set amount of time. With a steak, it could be cooking it for an hour at 132 degrees. For octopus, it could be 18 hours at 165 degrees. The benefit of cooking it sous vide, it's kind of like throwing a piece of chicken on a grill. It starts out as a nice long triangle, and the intense heat makes the proteins react, shrinking up the chicken into a little square. When you cook sous vide, the proteins are essentially massaged into being fully cooked, which keeps them very tender, whether it's a cooked braise or a regular piece of protein. In fact, it might be a great way to do it when you're trying to focus on the flavor of the tendon. Usually the flavor of the tendon is similar to bone marrow. It may be perhaps somewhat indescribable and maybe even slightly lacking in flavor. However, roasting it brings it out. Smoking it can bring out the flavor or at least accentuate, kind of a subtle flavor that you get out of some of those foods.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've seen it in Chinese markets. And I've always wondered, said to myself,
Kind of looks like a little alien fingers,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's very odd. But then I've thought, wow, I could add that to my borscht recipe, my cabbage savory borscht recipe. And that would probably be really good.
That sounds good. I apologize now if I steal it.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you very much.
Chris Morningstar is the executive chef at Ray's, the new restaurant at LACMA.
Come on, baby. I need gravy. Give me gravy tonight. I know you dance the mashed potato pie.
Kevin Sinnott is a nationally recognized coffee expert and the curator of CoffeeCompanion.com. We love talking to him about coffee, but today the conversation isn't quite about coffee. Kevin, what is this other product called cascara?
Cascara is it's actually an herb tea that's made from everything that you don't get when you buy coffee beans. It's the leaves, it's the cherry, the fruit. Think of it as a dried fruit preparation. And it looks like a real coarse herb tea. You don't grind it. You simply brew it like a tea. I would say it has a coffee down the hall taste. It tastes like it's reminiscent of coffee, but like a lot of herb teas that are made from other products come from them, like coffee. It really has elements of coffee flavor, but really it has more of a cherry taste and more of a licorice taste. Apple, maybe notes of apple, a rose petal, but there's really not a whole lot of coffee taste. It's not as if you made I suppose, imagined a coffee tea.
Does it have a basis in an old culture, or is it something that's been created to make farming coffee more profitable because it uses all the byproducts?
You know, you can't deny the coffee business is brilliant in opportunism here. And I'm not saying this in a cynical way. I think it's a good thing because they're finding another product that's really got a lot of health benefits from what they were. And they didn't throw it out, really, but they used to take all these byproducts, the coffee fruit, and they would make, in effect, compost it again and use it as fertilizer. So it's not as if it was something that was a waste product, but it's something that was part of the coffee process that they really didn't exploit fully. And you've got to hand it to them for that. But yes, it does, in answer to your question, yes, it predates, in fact, the earliest use of coffee had a drink that in the Mideast is sometimes called kesher or kesher. And it is a product that's often sweetened with cardamom and ginger maybe, and that's a tea, and that's made of the fruit of the coffee. I know of almost no one that really drinks it regularly, but once in a while at coffee events, someone has made it. And this is very similar. In fact, some people would probably argue it's exactly the same thing. There's one product that I would really strongly suggest you seek out an organic preparation, make sure it's labeled organic, because, you know, you really want the fruit of the coffee, even if sprays are used judiciously in the coffee business and growing, and I'm not really 100% opposed to that in some cases. I think it's done with caution, but it really doesn't affect coffee very much because the coffee is indeed, it's the seed and it's protected. But, you know, really the cascara really is not as protected. It's really the outside layer. It's the skin included, and it's the fruit, the flesh of the fruit. And you really want it to be organic preparation if you can.
Is it caffeinated like coffee is?
It has a certain amount of caffeine, but it's nowhere near the concentration of coffee.
Since we're talking about sort of not coffee, I was wondering if I could ask you about some other not coffees, like chicory, for example. What is chicory exactly, and how do people use it?
Chicory is an herb, and the truth is, historically, chicory was used when there were coffee shortages. I mean, there's just no other way about it. I've heard some speculation that, oh, you know, chicory had its own life, but really, no, it didn't. It's like the time that my older brother had to go away to school and my dad needed someone else to work in the family business and I was drafted. There was no other reason I was hired other than my brother was missing. That's true in coffee and chicory's case. Now, what chicory has is if it's toasted slightly, like a lot of grains, it has a malty type of flavor, and it has certainly whenever you heat herbs, there's a tendency to, in browning bread, for instance, increases the sugars, and that increases the perception of having something that tastes a bit like coffee. And chicory, I'll tell you, chicory is if you're talking to someone who's loves New Orleans culture, and I do, you can't consider coffee in New Orleans without considering chicory. But I also want to point out the famous Abraham Lincoln story that Abraham Lincoln came to a hotel and he said, bring me all the chicory in the hotel and set it before me. And they did so. And he said, is that all the chicory you have? And they said, yes, sir. And he said, fine, now go make me a cup of coffee. He was certainly a coffee connoisseur.
Now, what about this pinon coffee that I see occasionally at Trader Joe's?
Yes, pinon coffee is, and Trader Joe's has done a great job of marketing it. I know a lot of people that really enjoy it, and I've had it, and I enjoy it as well. Certainly, it originates in a Southwest United States culture, and it's a nut that is blended with coffee. And again, although I don't have the historical background on it that I do chicory, I'm reasonably sure that it was invented as a way of stretching the amount of coffee that you had and to be able to, feed more hungry people their cup of coffee. And It was a local, obviously a local nut that they found that they could toast it, get a malty flavor. And, you know, all this fit really well, by the way, in the late 1800s and the whole C.W. Post and Kellogg, you know, time period in the country that coffee was considered a beverage that had an intoxicating effect. It's like they decided that it was another form of liquor or something, and they had to get people away from it. It wasn't healthy in their views, and they were experimenting with all kinds of nuts and cereal beverages, postum, kava, all these other really cereal beverages that you could brew and you could get a quasi-coffee tasting, a warm drink. Remember, at that time, people didn't have access to refrigeration and a myriad of soft drinks, and I'm not sure we've come in any way progressed by having soft drinks instead, but we have access to a lot of refrigerated beverages, juices, that people didn't have then. So certainly pinon is one of them. Chicory would be another. Again, kava and postum.
I used to love postum when I was a little kid. I would feel like I was having a cup of coffee along with the adults. Well, thank you, Kevin.
Oh, thank you.
You can find Kevin Sinnott at coffeecompanion.com.
Okay, for our first real iCarly cooking segment, we're going to make spaghetti tacos. A dish invented by my brother Spencer, whose real name is Letitia McPeanuts. Yeah, no, it's not.
Have you ever had spaghetti tacos? Unless you are the parents of a tween, my guess is that your answer is no. The dish is a crazy combination created by a character on the hit Nickelodeon show iCarly.
All you need to make spaghetti tacos are
some taco shells,
some spaghetti noodles,
noodles.
Our secret sauce, and meatballs.
Our Deep End Diner Eddie Lin caught up with Jerry Traynor, the actor who plays Spencer. Check out the interview on the Good Food blog. I'll be back in 1 minute with a conversation about the tomato, the growing, the eating, and the politics of America's most prized fruit. That's next here on Good Food. Tomato, a perfect serving of sweet, acid, vegetal balance enclosed in a seductively colored orb, also known as the gateway drug to gardening. Food writer, journalist Barry Estabrook for years has been wondering what industrial ag has done to our most alluring fruit, the tomato. It can't have been easy to take something so naturally wonderful and imbue it with characteristics that range from tastelessness to slavery. Barry's new book is Tomato Land. So, Barry, how did we end up with the tomato as we know it today?
The tomato's origins are in the deserts of Western South America, from Ecuador down through Chile, in areas that in some places get almost no rain or very, very little. And there still are, in fact, the wild ancestor of all the tomatoes that we have today, all the shapes and sizes from cherries right up to great lumpen beefsteaks, still survives there. It's about the size of a large pea. It's red, and it tastes like a tomato. From there, it was taken, they don't really know how, but it was first domesticated in what's now southern Mexico, more than 1,000 miles away, and no one is really sure how it got from where it grew wild to where it was first domesticated.
You know, as a Californian, we're so close to Mexico, it's sort of like a default growing region for us as the seasons change throughout the year. But for most of the United States, that isn't so. It's Florida that seems to be the focus.
Florida is the source of about one-third of the fresh tomatoes that we eat a year in the United States. And during certain months in the winter, it's the source of 90% of the tomatoes that are eaten in the United States, the fresh tomatoes.
How did the tomato industry end up in Florida?
Well, first of all, it had nothing to do with horticulture or botany. In fact, from a horticultural or botanical point of view, you'd have to be an idiot to try to grow tomatoes commercially in Florida. Unlike California, and unlike the dry areas where tomatoes evolve, Florida's very, very humid. Unlike California, Florida's soils are awful. In fact, calling them soils is not an accurate term. It's sand, you know, not sandy soil, not sandy loam, sand like you get on Daytona Beach. So you've got these humid conditions and that encourage pests and funguses and insects, and you've got very infertile growing medium. The only reason tomatoes started to be grown commercially there, and the reason they're growing there today, is it's within a day's tractor trailer drive from two-thirds of the United States population, the Midwest and East.
So immediately from the very beginning, when Florida was embraced as a tomato-growing region, there had to be the type of inputs that we don't consider to be supernatural in order to make the plants thrive.
Oh, I spoke with one horticulturist at University of Florida and said, well, what if you didn't have inputs? What would you get? And she looked at me as if I were a very poor student and said, nothing. It wouldn't grow. It would just wither. You wouldn't have a thing. The soil has no organic material in it, and it has no nutrients in it. Prior to planting, they have to put all the food the tomato is going to have into the soil.
So give us an idea what the pesticide load is of these tomatoes that are grown in Florida. Like, how many different chemicals are used?
The official Florida State Tomato Growers Handbook, it's for commercial tomato growers, lists over 100 different pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides. And among them are some of the most potent. It's what the Pesticide Action Network calls their bad actors. Many of their bad actors are regularly applied to tomatoes. And they have people called scouts who go through the fields on a weekly basis and kind of do up a menu and hand it to the growers and say, this is what you spray this week.
And I understand that they even use a soil fumigant called methyl bromide that we know from strawberry fields in California, and many people are trying to get it banned.
Well, in fact, yes, they do use methyl bromide, and tomatoes and strawberries are among the very few crops where it still can be used. Officially, methyl bromide is so bad, it's so bad for the ozone layer of the atmosphere, that it was banned outright and was supposed to be gone by 2005. But each year, the United States gets an exemption. It's called a critical use exemption, to apply the stuff to primarily tomatoes and strawberries. And what it does is it's like chemotherapy for the soil. It's a fumigant. It's a gas. It's blowing into the soil. Then the soil's covered with plastic, and it's allowed to sit for a couple of weeks, and it kills everything, every living insect, every living bacteria, every living germ. The soil is rendered lifeless, and then it's ready to get planted.
I start to think about the effect of the workers. Do they wear protective clothing?
Unfortunately, absolutely not. You know, like most farm workers, the people that pick tomatoes are very, very poor, and they can't afford that sort of protection, nor are they required by law to have it provided to them. One of the most common things that I heard talking to workers in Florida is that getting sprayed is like a regular occurrence.
What are some of the health hazards caused by this copious use of chemicals? Do you have any personal stories that you're aware of you can share?
Well, the most distressing example I came across was three young women who were made to work in a tomato field during the course of their pregnancies. They didn't want to, but their boss said that then they couldn't have the little trailer that they lived in. He'd take that away, so they had to work. I mean, because they were pregnant, they had to work because they needed a place once the babies came. The mothers gave birth within a couple of months of each other. All three of the babies were horribly deformed. One died right away. They couldn't even tell whether it was a boy or a girl, and a few days after birth it died. Another had a severe jaw deformity, and the final one was born with neither arms nor legs. And these women worked side by side with each other throughout their pregnancies and were sprayed with chemicals that are known to cause birth defects.
Now, I know that there have to be postings of the effects of harmful chemicals. Are these posted in ways that workers can have access to?
Well, in a Florida tomato field, right at the gate, and it's often a guarded gate, there is a sign which lists all of the chemicals that may be applied to that field. There's one problem, is that most of the workers, they not only don't read English, they're very unlikely to read Spanish. Most of them are indigenous people who come from the mountainous areas of southern Mexico and Guatemala. So these warnings are posted, but no one can read them.
If you're just joining me, I'm talking with Barry Estabrook, a food writer who's written extensively about how tomatoes are farmed in the U.S., mostly in Florida. In his research, he's uncovered some pretty shocking stories about how workers are treated. I asked him to elaborate about the relationship between these workers and the owners of the mega tomato farms.
Yeah, in Florida, the vast majority of commercial tomatoes are grown by 12 huge companies, which farm thousands of acres. And they've had a system set up over the years that puts them one step removed away from the people who actually work in the fields. They hire labor contractors, and it's the labor contractor whose job it is to assemble a team of workers and manage them on a day-to-day basis. So the company can sort of say, oh, we're shocked. We don't know what's going on. Or we didn't do it. Our contractor did.
You famously written for Gourmet a few years ago about the near slavery conditions of workers, particularly in the Immokalee area. Could you just touch on that a bit?
I'm going to have to correct you a little bit, Evan.
Okay.
Near slavery is the wrong term. Abject slavery is the correct term. Let's go down a couple of these are all proven cases that have come to trial or come to court. Being locked up every night, being shackled in chains, being beaten by the boss if you are either too weak to work, too sick to work, too hungover to work, or just don't feel like working, being severely beaten if you try to escape, and receiving virtually no pay, if any pay. That's slavery.
You know as much as anybody right now in the U.S. about these conditions. What do you think it's going to take for there to be a change?
Well, you know, things have taken a dramatic improvement for the better since I started researching tomato land a couple of years ago. In the fall, after more than a decade of pressure from a group called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, the Florida Tomato Growers Exchange, which represents these 12 large growers who raise most of Florida's tomatoes, finally agreed to accept what's called the Fair Food Code of Conduct. And that gives the workers some very, very primitive basic rights, you know, the right to have health committee members in each work crew who understand that, the right to a basic grievance procedure, the right to be educated about the rights that American workers have. And plus, they get a penny a pound raise, provided the big buyers, the supermarkets and the fast food joints, agree to pay that. You know, penny a pound sounds like nothing to you and I, but it's the difference between making $50 and $80 a day to one of these workers.
So what do these non-seasonal tomatoes in Florida look like when they're picked?
They look exactly like a green Granny Smith apple. They're completely green. They're called mature greens, but to you and I, they're unripe tomatoes that haven't even started to show a blush of pink. They're picked that way because they're hard, and they can withstand being handled and shipped to their eventual destination and will store for a week or two.
How do they turn red?
They're taken from the field to these large warehouses where they're stacked in pallets, and then they turn on ethylene gas and expose the warehouses full of tomatoes to the gas, which causes them to turn a beautiful shade of red-orange, but it doesn't cause them to ripen. They just look ripe. It's a funny thing because study after study has shown that of all the items in the produce department, Americans register the most complaints and the least degree of satisfaction with tomatoes.
Thank you so much, Barry.
Always good talking to you, Evan.
Barry Esterbrook's new book is Tomatoland. I've got links to some of Barry's pieces about the politics of the tomato at kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, Jonathan Gold's here with a restaurant for us to try. This is KCRW and kcrw.com. Welcome back to Good Food. I'm your host, Evan Kleinman. One of the best parts of eating in L.A. is the variety. You can find some of the best meals of your life here, whether it be in a strip mall or a more high-end establishment. We're very lucky that Jonathan Gold takes us to both. Jonathan, of course, is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the L.A. Weekly, and he joins us here every week with a restaurant recommendation. Today, we're going to West Hollywood.
We're
going to
eat Middle Eastern food, or sort of abstracted Middle Eastern food, at a new restaurant called Meza in the space that until very recently housed Sona.
So who's behind it? Who's in the kitchen?
The chef is Michael Wexler, who's cooked a bunch of places in town, probably for the longest at Kraft, and I think was somewhat involved in designing the menu at Voyer.
Is it a tapas-based menu?
Like every restaurant that seems to have opened in Los Angeles in the last year, it's a small plates menu. So you sit down, you order whatever drink it is, and then you order, as the name of the restaurant implies, just a parade of meze that come to the table. And some are fairly traditional. I mean, the tabbouleh may have green garlic and fava bean and pancetta in it. Actually, pancetta couldn't be a less traditional ingredient.
No, could not be a less traditional ingredient.
but it's like completely recognizable as tabbouleh. I mean,
it's a taboo tabbouleh.
Yeah, it is. This restaurant is not halal, in case you were wondering about that. And you get a series of small courses. They have subspecialty in flatbreads, which are more or less like very thin-crusted pizzas topped with things like squash blossoms and sort of Syrian string cheesy thing and the wild
halloumi.
Probably halloumi. And the herb mixture called za'atar, or with roasted green cauliflower and olives and feta.
That actually sounds really delicious.
It is delicious.
When I think about meze, I often think about stuffed vegetables. Do they have any stuffed vegetables on the menu?
They don't have stuffed vegetables. It doesn't come from any particular tradition. And if you're used to going to Turkish restaurants, I mean, you'll probably find some things that you'll recognize. But there's also, for example, a crudo of salmon with a soft cheese that's very much like cream cheese and with little rye crisps. And it's like a deconstructed lox bagel and cream cheese.
Interesting.
And tasty. That I've never been to a Middle Eastern restaurant and gotten a foie gras tagine with saffron and the labneh.
Wow. So foie gras served with labneh, which is like super fatty, drained yogurt.
Right.
Fat and fat.
Fat and fat. And there's a little bit of watermelons, a little bit of pistachio, but the overwhelming sensation is of richness. Though, of course, the labneh is super tart, which cuts through that taste. There's a version of shakshuka.
Describe what shakshuka is.
It's sautéed vegetables like peppers and onions, like melted down with a egg on top.
I love it.
This one comes with like a little yogurt foam on the top and little nuggets of fried sweetbreads.
Wow, that sounds so interesting. What's the room like?
If you know the Sona room, which was very minimal and very subdued, they've opened it up. They've splashed paint on the walls. It's more or less an open kitchen. And there's a liveliness that definitely wasn't there
Okay, continue to tantalize us with plates.
There is Monty, those little dumplings that are done so well at, say, the Armenian restaurant Monty in the Valley, that are topped with, instead of the heavy yogurty sauce that's traditional, I guess, everywhere from Lebanon all the way through Afghanistan, it's topped with a light sauce made with almond milk.
Ooh.
Which is nice because it gives just that little bit of richness and a little bit of obviously nuttiness and a little bit of sweetness without overwhelming the flavor of the meat. There's little shawarma sandwiches. I guess they'd be the equivalent of sliders.
Shawarmettes.
That are sauced with the odd Iraqi Jewish mango sauce called amba.
I've never heard of this sauce before.
It's big in New York, I guess. It's in the kosher Middle Eastern restaurants way out, like past Avenue U.
Wow, how interesting.
There's a very decent version of the salad fattoush, which is usually made with chopped whatever's in the kitchen with handfuls of za'atar and to season it and crispy bits of pita bread. This one is made with, the boutique Little Jim lettuces. And the pita is somehow delicate, and the sumac isn't thrown on with as heavy a hand as is often the case. It's the most tasteful fattoush I've ever had. It's not one of those things that you like crunch through. It's you savor.
And it has a super lemony profile from the sumac.
Yeah.
I love it.
There are a couple of large plates, which again are like sort of plunked in the middle of the table for sharing. Probably the most notable of which is the Cornish hen, which has been rubbed with za'atar again. You can't escape it in this restaurant. I'm not sure why you'd want to. So there's an herbiness. There's a tartness. It's crusted. It's juicy. It's cut up in this thing in the middle of the table. And when you're at Meze and you're like thinking of vegetables to get, you might as well get the fool made with what they call heirloom beans, which are nice. It's not the same dried fava thing you get everywhere else, and it has a nice flavor to it, and the flavor of the preserved lemon and the really strong olive oil comes out nicely.
Well, it sounds really, really delicious. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold of the LA Weekly about Meze on La Cienega between Melrose and Beverly. Get the exact address and a list of recommended dishes by texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. Find a complete list of Jonathan's restaurant recommendations on our map. Find it on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. With the fight about the debt ceiling in the news, it's good to remember the possible effects of all this budget wrangling. Last March, 4,000 people participated in a national fast just to call attention to congressional budget proposals. Some of these proposals would make huge cuts in programs for the poor and hungry. Eventually, $2.5 billion was eliminated from key programs needed by people at risk as a result of the approved fiscal year 2011 budget. Debbie Shores, the co-founder and associate director of Share Our Strength. Share Our Strength, of course, is that national nonprofit aimed at ending childhood hunger in America. She joins us today to discuss the hunger issue and continual threat to its funding. Debbie, for a lot of people, the words hunger, and particularly childhood hunger, and America don't compute in the same sentence. What is the current state of hunger and food security in the U.S.?
Well, it's really reached epidemic proportion. There are just under 50 million Americans who are struggling with hunger in this country. And what that means is they're not sure where their next meal will come from or if they'll have enough for their families. And that translates to about 17 million, U.S. children. It's about one in four kids in America. This is one of the highest numbers we've seen since we've started the organization back in 1984.
And traditionally, what programs help people that are in this situation?
Well, there are plenty. I mean, the beauty of this, of our No Kid Hungry campaign, there are plenty of programs in place the irony of this is that there's plenty of food, there's plenty of programs, and there's plenty of services in America to feed kids. What happens is they don't always have access to those programs and services. So our No Kid Hungry campaign is dedicated to, you know, understanding what the barriers are and to make sure that we eliminate those barriers and let the federal funds flow so that kids can get the nutritious food they need to eat and grow and thrive.
Talk a little bit about these barriers. What are they?
The big ones, I would say, are transportation, right? So if school breakfast is available at your school, not all kids get to school on time, right? Some families are dropping off two kids. They have early morning, you know, work hours. And so by the time they get to school, the breakfast in the cafeteria is gone. So one of the barriers is transportation. Another one is stigma. A lot of kids feel, you know, they don't really want to go in the line where the kids who don't, you know, get breakfast at home go. So they feel kind of stigmatized. There are complications in the forms for families to fill out. There's just general awareness that these programs even exist. So those are basically the barriers. And one of the most successful campaigns that we've been launching is to get breakfast in the classroom. And we know that if breakfast is in the classroom, that the eligible kids are eating it, and their test scores are higher, and they're sick less often, and they get the food they need to go throughout the day and learn and be productive.
Where does the federal funding come into all this?
We've calculated there's about $1 billion, that's B, billion dollars, available, already authorized, for a lot of these programs. So there's money available in the federal government to pay for these programs, but the barriers prevent the funding from being utilized, from coming down into the state.
And where does LA rank in terms of the number of hungry kids? Are we at the top, at the bottom, or in the middle?
You're at the top. California's at the top. California and Texas, by sheer numbers of residents, right? So the hungriest kids, not the percentages, but the highest level of hungry kids live in the biggest populated state. So California and Texas are up there. I'm not sure which is one. I think it's California, actually. There are roughly a million, between teenagers and kids, a million kids and teens at risk in the city of Los Angeles. So given the size of the state in California, we're biting off LA first.
Thank you so much, Debbie.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Debbie Shore is the co-founder of Share a Strength. Their big annual benefit is Taste of the Nation, taking place tomorrow in Culver City. Many of LA's best restaurants will be represented, along with a selection of craft beer, wine, and spirits. Infos at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast at kcrw.com/goodfood or at iTunes. Info on all of today's guests is on our blog, along with all of the pie recipes you could ever want. Don't forget to download this week's bonus podcast, The Pie Cast. Good Food's produced and edited by Harriet Ells, with Jillian Ferguson, Candace Moyer, and Laurel Garcia. Thanks to Ray Guarna, Ronnie Mickelson, Gary Messiha, and Taryn Olson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.